This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 97-year-old retired Army Colonel Tom Hidalgo of Creston, California, originally from Santa Barbara, where he experienced the infamous 1925 earthquake. Tom would be involved in some of World War II's most famous battles, serving with the 980th Field Artillery Battalion, and that includes the invasion of Normandy. Tom came ashore on Utah Beach just a couple of days after the first troops stormed those beaches.
I wasn't on the initial wave. One of our units was on the initial wave, where the infantry have companies in the artillery. We have batteries. Our B battery went ashore on D-Day. We came in right after D-Day. We were still getting shore fire. Not as dense as it was for the initial waves, but there was still a lot of people being killed.
Well, and I've got a couple questions on that. First, what happened to that B battery that went in on June 6th?
They made it ashore. There were some people that got shot up, but like in every other unit, if your unit went ashore on D-Day and you didn't get shot up, you were lucky.
So when did you go in, and what did you see as you were coming in?
We went ashore about the second or third day. We were loaded on some, like a raft made out of steel. And they had like little plows, and they would take you and load so many people on because there were many obstacles, and you had to clear those obstacles. Otherwise, you'd get hung up on them, and you were a sitting target out there. So they'd push you with these little plows, like, and you floated right over those obstacles, or they'd push you where there were no obstacles, but everybody was trying to get where there were no obstacles, you know, and sure, you couldn't all go there. So you tried to float over those obstacles, and the minute that barge hit the sand or hit one of those underwater obstacles, you jumped off and waded ashore or swam ashore, or somehow you had to get ashore, because you had to get to that sandbank up there to use it to keep from getting shot.
Tell me about your personal experience. Did you have to jump into the water and wade in?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, just coming off the ship, one of the cables that was had anchored off, somebody unsnapped it beforehand, and it was dangling back and forth and hit me on this arm. I thought I wasn't going to make it ashore, but I had help and I got ashore.
And how much were you carrying? What were you loaded down with?
You had your own personal gear, your rifle, and enough ammunition to sustain you for a while. You knew that once you got ashore, you were going to get resupply from what was already on shore.
So I just want to understand the scene here. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's artillery going off. There's probably machine gun fire. You've got a bunch of other ships in the area, and you're getting off this raft or barge into the water. You get hit by that cable. You're not sure if you're going to drown or not. And then you're trying to figure out how to get onto terra firma. That had to be a pretty chaotic scenario.
Well, we had leaders, and you follow those leaders. They generally had some type of a colored bandana or something that you could see. You could visualize and see them, but you follow those guys. Everybody had a group that they followed. It wasn't just a helter-skelter deal. It was everybody knew what he had to do and how he had to do it. We had practiced that before, and so it wasn't something new. It was just follow the leader, you know?
But I'm sure as you keep your eyes on the leader and you're trying to follow him, you're seeing...
What happened to that leader, then you had second thoughts. So who do I follow now?
Can you help us understand that scene? What else is going on around you?
They had beachmasters. Once you got ashore, then you followed whatever the beachmaster told you. That's where you went. He knew who was coming ashore, when they were coming ashore. It was pretty well organized. And if there was any errors, it's because you didn't follow instructions.
But I'm just imagining that as you come ashore and you're following the leader, you were probably also confronted with some of the things that had already happened there. There's probably death and destruction around you.
Well, there was a lot of dead people. Some of them were floating on the beach, and that's very demoralizing. So wherever we had a chance, we'd grab one of these dead bodies and drag it up and put it on the beach. Then they had trucks policing the beach and picking up all those dead and getting them on the ships back to England.
And I mean, I'm just imagining, you couldn't have ever seen anything like that before, right?
No. No, you didn't visualize, saying that many casualties.
So how did you deal with that? I mean, how did you keep going and avoid...
Survival of the fittest, you know. You just, if you didn't want to join them, you better move.
So you were still getting shot at, or you heard fire?
Yes. Up until the time that you got behind that big sandbank, you were an open target. From all these obstacles they had stuck in the sand, barbed wire entanglements and all that, you had to cut them or go around them. It was much easier to cut them. But once you cut them, then it would whiplash back, and you don't know where it went after that. So there was something about cutting them that you hesitated to do that, because you cut it here and the tension would coil that thing up and it might strike through for other people down the road.
So there's hazards everywhere. And I'm sure throughout the rest of the war, there must have been some other close calls for you. But just coming ashore there at Normandy, what do you think was the closest something came to you there?
I don't know. I don't remember paying too much attention. So my thought was to survive and get ashore. And that was everybody's aim. Get ashore. Get behind that sandbank. You know, the tide comes in and washes off and leaves a kind of a big bank, and that's where you wanted to be, because you were camouflaged there behind that, and you had a good pile of dirt in front of you that those bullets weren't going to. And those Germans up there in those pillboxes, they were just shoveling it to you.
But it probably wouldn't be exaggerating to say that machine gun fire must have come within 50 or less feet of you?
Oh, yeah, there was, I don't remember, because I was self-preservation, you know, move in, never mind about the next guy. Somebody got shot ahead of you and you could help him, get him to cover. Well, you grabbed him and put him behind the sandbank, and the medics would come along and pick those people up. Some of those guys would probably be dead by the time the medics got to them, because there were so many of them. We went across the, right behind the sandbanks was a big lagoon, big marsh area. One little road going across that marsh, that led us into the town of St. Mary Gleese. After we went across that pond or that lagoon there, the colonel in charge of our unit said, just pull off the side of the road. We had already bypassed the German pillboxes, so we were behind them, so they weren't going to be shooting at us anymore. We were to cut down all the paratroopers that were caught in the trees. The Germans had shot them. They got tangled up in the trees, and the Germans shot them. You remember that story, that movie about that guy got caught up in the...
John Steele got hung up on the steeple of the church in St. Mary Gleese?
Yeah, well, a funny thing about it, I later on in life became a ham radio operator. I worked a fellow over in France. He was telling me about that guy, and I told him, you don't have to tell me about him. I was there. And I got a card from him after talking to him on my shortwave radio.
But so you and the other guys in your group had to go cut paratroopers, dead paratroopers down?
We had to cut down paratroopers. We spent a good portion of the day cutting down paratroopers, because the colonel said that's very demoralizing to any subsequent troops, seeing all our people hanging in the trees, because they got caught in the trees and the Germans shot them there.
Well, yeah, it would have been demoralizing for the troops coming in, and it couldn't have been easy for you to have that duty.
Well, when you're occupied and doing something, there's very few things that you think about, only survival.
So how long was it till your battery actually got set up where they could start firing those big guns?
Well, that same afternoon. We already had one unit ashore, which was our B battery, so they located us, and we married up with them, and now we had a battalion together. First of all, we had to cut off the peninsula. You know, the Cherbourg sits way out here, and there's a big peninsula out there. So we cut off the peninsula, and then we headed north and went to Cherbourg and cleared that off. Then we came back and then got ready for around July, the St. Lo breakthrough.
And these are some of the major points of this invasion. I mean, the breakout at St. Lo was a huge thing. Just taking Cherbourg was big too. But what were you doing personally during that time? Were you doing those computations?
Getting the maps and picking out the targets. Infantry units would call us when they got into a place where they couldn't break through with their fire, so they'd call us and tell us where it was at. We'd shoot it or blast it out of the way.
So you had to stay where the guns were, or did you have to go out in front of your artillery pieces?
No, we had forward observers who send their fire requests down to where I was in the fire control center. We took it from there.
So they're giving you this information. You're looking at a map, and you're doing the math to say, if we fire from point A at this angle, then we should hit the German forces that are there.
That's exactly what we were doing.
How did that work out? How accurate were your calculations?
Well, our maps were good, so we were only as good as the maps, because that's where we got our ranges from, and that's where we could plot where the enemy was and where we were. And knowing those two places, we didn't want to shoot at ourselves, so we had to shoot at them.
Well, and yeah, and I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking, here you are, you're what, 24 years old, 23, 24?
Heck, I was 23 years old.
And here, I mean, you joined the military a couple years before, and you think you're going to play music in uniform, and that's your big job. But now you're in charge of not just one gun, but all these huge 13 giant artillery pieces that can kill a lot of people. Artillery. The calculations that you...
So I'd do a lot of the calculations and then pass them on to some other guy who would send them to the guns. And then, meantime, I'm working on another one, you know, get the firing data for that one to shoot.
Well, and I'm just thinking about this, and I'm thinking about our world today and the people who are listening. Some of them may like math, some of them may not. They've all had math tests that they've probably been anxious about, but you've got nonstop math tests, and the stakes are life and death.
Today, it's a different problem. Technology is such that where before we used firing tables and logarithms and all that's gone, you know. You don't have to worry about formulas or that anymore. Everything's in a little computer, and you press the keys and gives you the answers. You don't have to know the math. All you have to know is what keys to punch.
But you had to know the math, and if you were wrong, it could kill civilians or it could kill your own troops.
Well, yeah, if you came up with the wrong deal. But very seldom that you come up with the wrong deal.
But I imagine you felt the weight of that responsibility.
Oh, sure. I have a piece of paper, and I have a little book that I kept of all the places, all the different cities and the different towns that we set up at. Then we had to go to a little place called Sini, and we had to change all our tubes because they were worn out. You know, after you fire so many rounds through it, all the lens and grooves in there that give the twist to the projectile get worn out, and they no longer spiral like a football, you know.
You don't want to fire knuckleballs.
Yeah.
How long did you keep doing this? I mean, were you over there for the rest of the war?
I kept doing that till we got to Germany. Then I came home. The war was over about around May the 8th, about two or three days after the war was officially over. I was on my way home.
And I want to hear about that and seeing Jenny again and all that. But I'm thinking if you were there from Normandy through VE Day, there are probably a lot of other things that you were involved in. For instance, the Battle of the Bulge. Where were you during that time?
We headed off the Bulge. We raced around and put ourselves right where the enemy was coming. So then we helped slow down that advance because they were ready to break on through.
Well, and everyone who was involved in the Bulge, you know, they talk about the enemy, but they also talk about the weather. So what was your experience with that winter?
Well, the weather was very bad. You know, it was snowing, cold. We had... Recently, they had converted fuses. They took that from the anti-aircraft weapons. You know, they fire and the fuse is set, comes near a plane and it explodes. So they adopted that to the artillery. They fire the shell. When it comes near the ground up at a certain height, it explodes and it covers a big area, you know, with shell fragments flying all over. And they call those composite fuses. I remember just before the Bulge, we got those fuses. We had to go over to Holland to pick them up.
So that allowed you to fire anti-personnel shells, basically?
Yeah. We broke up the fire direction center. We broke it up to two 12-hour shifts, four 2-week period, we'd handle the day shift. At the end of 2-week period, we'd shift over to the night. The night crew would take over the day. So that it wasn't a hardship on any one group. It was kind of alike by both groups. There were about 9 or 10 people in each one of those fire control groups. They were commanded by a major.
Tom wasn't a major yet, but eventually he would be. In fact, he finished his 35-year Army career as a colonel. But I have a few more questions about those days as a sergeant during World War II. When we come back, we're going to dig deeper into something that was starting right about this time all those years ago. December 16th, 1944 is when the Battle of the Bulge began. I know you can hear how young Tom sounds at age 97, but if you want to see what he looks like, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll bring you down the home stretch right after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight.
Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free
because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.